times of revolution and civil war, when the survival of the regime was at stake, whatever means are expedient are by definition just and usable. Or as he put it, Trotsky put it, who aims at the end cannot reject the means. But in fact, he went further than this moral utilitarianism. If it's useful, it's good. For Trotsky, the end not only justified the means, the end ennobled the means. It made them moral. Thus, for example, he argued that the White Terror and the Red Terror, even if they looked equally violent, were not the same thing from a moral point of view. The White Terror was about preserving oppression, the interests of a few, and therefore it was morally bad. The Red Terror was about emancipating the majority of the population, and therefore was good terror. Now, during the 1920s, Trotsky's belief in the creative value of coercion, if the goal is good, that is, was translated into his economic program and into his critique of the course that NEP had adopted. I should say, though, first, that his argument was also shaped by two other key beliefs, beliefs he shared with many communists, including, by the way, Lenin. First of all, Russia's abysmal backwardness was its greatest problem, the greatest obstacle for building socialism. And this meant not just economic backwardness, but also what he described as Russia's fundamental and deep cultural backwardness, the lack of good working habits among workers, too much drinking, too much swearing, too much ignorance of the world of ideas, including a superstitious belief in religion, all of which was a sign of how backward the Russian nation still was. Second idea was related to this, namely the central importance of a vanguard. Since the people were too backward to take charge, to emancipate themselves, the vanguard, the state and the party and its leaders, had to take the lead. Now, these ideas about backwardness and leadership and coercion shaped his criticisms of the mainstream party policies during NEP. Made by many other, these same arguments were made by many other Bolsheviks who became known collectively as the left within the movement. First of all, he had economic criticisms. To overcome Russia's backwardness, industrialization must be put on the top of the agenda. And this requires long-term economic planning, and that requires capital investment that had to be accumulated by the state in order to build up this economy through planning. This, to get the money to invest, to build up industry, requires squeezing the private sector. And the way the private sector had to be squeezed was through high taxes, high industrial prices, all set by the state, low wages, controlled by the state, and low investment in consumer goods in order to invest in industry. In other words, the only way to overcome Russia's backwardness and create the foundation for building a happy, free, socialist society is through an activist, intrusive economic policy by the state. Trotsky, though, didn't just limit his criticisms to economics. He also felt, as many others did, that the party's authoritarianism and bureaucratization within itself was harmful to socialism. And his critique was very sweeping. He complained about the tendency developed during the Civil War to appoint party leaders at the local level, party secretaries who became local dictators. He called for mass initiative and participation in party affairs. He called for party members to change their very style and culture, to develop a better habit of being free to express their views, of independent thought. He denounced what he called yes men became normal within the party, and remind party members that a Bolshevik's not just a disciplined person, but a person, these are his words, who forges a firm opinion of his own and defends it courageously and independently. His ideal, in other words, was a forceful party, a forceful state, leading the way in transforming Russia, but he believed that that leadership had to be free and vital within itself. And in particular, he worried a great deal about Stalin's role, Joseph Stalin's role, in limiting this vital, free life within the party. You'll hear more about Stalin next time. Trotsky's major opponent in these debates was a man named Nikolai Bukharin, born in 1888, died in 1938. Stalin was a major ally at this point of Bukharin's. It might be relevant to begin by remembering that as a human being, as a person, Bukharin was a very different sort of person than Lev Trotsky, or than Stalin, but we'll hear more about him. By every account, Trotsky was self-confident to the point of absolute arrogance, an individualist to the extreme, and brutal in his polemics. By contrast, Bukharin was one of the best-liked leaders of the party. Lenin, in one of his last writings in December of 1922, called him the beloved of the whole party. He called Trotsky, by contrast, the most able man in the whole party. In fact, even Bukharin's opponents in ideology agreed that he was a nice guy, sensitive, good nature. In fact, even his appearance was gentle. While lots of Bolsheviks, including Trotsky, tended to like to wear military dress in the 1920s to remind them of that Civil War tough style, Bukharin insisted on dressing like an old bohemian intellectual. He looked more like he ought to be sitting in a cafe in perhaps Western Europe than leading the heroic advance of the Soviet government. These personal characteristics reflected deeper convictions and values. Above all, Bukharin opposed the economic arguments of Trotsky and the left. He felt that they were economically flawed. He agreed with the left and virtually everyone else in Russia and Soviet Russia that Russia's backwardness was a serious obstacle to everything the communists wanted to achieve. But he drew different conclusions from this backwardness. He was very skeptical about the statist economic ideals of the left, planning, forced accumulation, and development. He feared that this would create a massive apparatus in order to bring about this planned development of the economy. And he argued that this would not work. This would simply impede economic growth. Such a big planning apparatus was inefficient and impractical. He agreed industrialization was necessary, that the resources, even, he admitted, would have to come from the most largest part of the economy, the peasant economy. But he favored a plan based on consumption rather than forced production. He argued that this investment capital would grow naturally out of the market if the focus was on consumer goods rather than big machine plants. If you produced for consumption, people would buy more. As people bought more, more money would go back into industry, and this natural cycle would develop the economy more effectively, even if more slowly. However, his arguments were not just economic, and this really gets to the heart of thinking about Bukharin's and other people's stance of what became known as the right in the 1920s. Like Lenin, Bukharin saw a fundamental political need to maintain peasant acceptance of Bolshevism. He argued, as Lenin did, that one must teach the peasants why socialism is a good thing. Convert them, not force it down their throats, much less force them to pay dearly for industrialization. In his words, one should approach the peasant with love, not hate. And the program of the left, Trotsky's program, he feared, would alienate peasants immediately, would probably lead to a rise of peasant rebellions, as we saw in 1920-21, which would require massive use of military force, which would only alienate them further and, in fact, undermine the whole project of socialism. His image was of a gradual, evolutionary road to socialism, not the road of violent class struggle, not the road of coercion by the state, but in his own words, this is from 1925, a road to socialism that would be peaceful and bloodless without the clanging of metal weapons. Now, as this may suggest, there was not simply economic or even political considerations in Bukharin's attack on the left, on Trotsky, but also what really must be called ethical and moral considerations. Bukharin believed that socialism, this emancipatory ideal, could not be built with the same tools as capitalism. The means and the ends had to fit together more clearly. Capitalism, though he admitted it was, as all Marxists did, was historically progressive, was, Bukharin argued, like most Marxists argued, cruel and brutal. It was driven by, in Bukharin's words, conquest, enslavement, robbery, and murder. Socialism couldn't act that way. Socialism was to be transformative and uplifting. Different ends, therefore different means. Now, throughout the 1920s, the party debated all of these questions with enormous consequences, as I'll describe in more detail next time. The left first was defeated, pushed out of the party leadership and the government, and the alliance, by an alliance of Bukharin's followers together with Stalin. Trotsky was expelled from the party. He was then exiled to Central Asia. And in 1929, he was thrown out of the country as a whole. Then Stalin, who controlled the whole apparatus of the party, as you'll see, turned against Bukharin and forced him and the right out, the right wing out of party leadership. We'll look at Stalin and his methods next time, including the deadly results for both sides of this debate, both Trotsky and Bukharin, personally, and many of their followers. First, though, it's useful to briefly remember what's going on outside the party at this time. In part, as we've already seen, Soviet society in the 1920s was a continuation of the old Russian life. Old forms of business, private enterprise, old forms of pleasure, ranging from decadent cafes and cinemas playing Western films to nightclubs and casinos. Crime and corruption, poverty, as well as progress, and increasing returned, but also increasing inequality. However, society in the 1920s was also a site for continued idealism about making a new society. In particular, as during the Civil War, there were experiments to transform everyday life, to create a new society and new people. For example, many people, especially young people, organized communes where they lived together, they cooked together, they ate together, they sometimes raised children collectively, and insisted on absolute equality between men and women, and in many cases, complete freedom in intimate relations between men and women. An echo of the idealism of the 1860s became very much part of 1920s practice. Many individual women also were active in the movement to complete acquire complete personal freedom, to love whom they wished, to raise children without a spouse if they wished, to work at any job they wished. And in fact, the party encouraged this sort of idealism, this sort of women's movement. There was extensive experimentation in all sorts of fields, city planning, education, the organization of life in factories. In fact, a rather typical experiment of the time was a thing called an orchestra without a conductor. This was a very good orchestra. It traveled around the country that lacked a conductor. They felt that a conductor was a symbol of old-fashioned authoritarianism, and they were to be a collective, to be free. This was a characteristic experiment of the 1920s, part of what society, as well as many communists, were seeking. Or another case, perhaps the most bizarre movement of the time, but really quite typical, was a movement known as Down with Shame. These members of this movement believe that the only clothing that was truly egalitarian, truly free, which is what the whole revolution was supposed to be about, was no clothing at all. They believed, in fact, further, that it was only shame over the naked body, Philistine values, that led people to wear clothes. And so, they demonstrated this emancipatory ideal by going naked in public. To be sure, only in the summertime. It's very cold in Russia in the winter. In fact, by 1922, which was the high point of this movement, there were evenings of the naked body in major cities, nude marches through the major capitals of the Soviet Union. There was even a famous case in which trolley cars were occupied by a bunch of naked people from the movement wearing sashes that said nothing but "Down with Shame." They were arrested. Needless to say, the police weren't so impressed. However odd these little stories may seem, these movements, they were no less part of the diversity of the Soviet experiment in the 1920s. And it's no wonder that once Stalin began his dramatic new revolution at the end of the 20s, many began to look back to the new economic policy period as a golden age of multiple possibilities and imagination and vision and freedom and open debate. This debate was slowly stifled in the 1920s and silenced altogether under Stalin. And it's to Stalin who we'll turn in the next lecture.
Lecture 30, Joseph Stalin.
In this lecture, we look at a period in Russian history, in Soviet history, that more than any other is associated with a single name. And that's the name of Joseph Stalin, or as he was known at birth, Yosef Djugashvili. He lived from 1879 to 1953, and as his natural name suggests, born in Georgia, in the formerly Russian, part of the Russian Empire, and now again part of the Soviet Union. He ruled the USSR from 1928 to 1953, for 25 years. And he ruled it with great force and control, as will be seen. These were important years for the development of the Soviet Union, periods of enormous change, but also important periods of conflict, and certainly as well of suffering. These were the years that included rapid forced industrialization, which started in 1928, a time of great suffering, but also considerable economic progress. These were years of forced collectivization of peasants, starting in 1930, which provided considerable investment capital to build up industry, but at huge human and indeed economic cost, as will be seen. These were years of mass terror, starting in the mid-1930s, a terror in which most scholars believe millions were killed. This was a period in which the Soviet Union engaged in one of its most greatest challenges and most brutal, the Second World War, a time of enormous human suffering, but also great heroism. And these were also years in which millions of people believed Stalin was truly one of their greatest leaders. Years in which, in fact, standards of living for many people did, in fact, improve. And also years in which people, despite all of these complications, tried to live a normal life, which also affected the nature of Soviet life in these years. Now, before one turns to all these events and the history of the society and its politics, my subject in the next few lectures, we must start with the man who stood at the center of the Stalinist period in Soviet history, who put in many ways his own personal stamp on this period, Stalin himself. Now, one has to start in some ways with what might be described as Stalin's essential political personality, as already visible in his youth, growing up in his native Georgia. Everyone who knew a young Djugashvili, to use his original name and the name at that point, everyone who knew him noted that he was a particularly angry young man, very unlike, people said, a typical Georgian who was rather relaxed and easygoing and liked to tell jokes. In fact, Stalin, as he became known, Djugashvili, was said to be so angry that scholars have referred to him as having an essential rebel personality. He rebelled. He felt a need to rebel against everything, and in particular, against every manifestation of authority in his life. Some people have argued that this is partly a redirected aggression, rebellion against his father, who was quite cruel, often beat both young Djugashvili and his mother. For example, a sign of this pervasive rebellion against authority. When Djugashvili was sent to a seminary by his mother to receive an education and become a priest, he became known as a troublemaker among these young seminary students. To quote, for example, from the seminary conduct book, which kept track of how every student did, it read as follows: "In general, pupil Djugashvili is rude and disrespectful toward persons in authority, and systematically fails to bow to one of his teachers." Soon, Djugashvili, the future Stalin, extended this sort of petty and pervasive defiance of all authority into truly political defiance. He joined an underground circle of the Social Democratic Party, of the Marxist Party, for which, of course, he was almost immediately expelled from the seminary, being a member of an illegal organization. Complicating all this, the future Stalin was known to be insecure and defensive as an individual. In fact, it was known that when people made a joke at his expense, he very often immediately responded with fists. And again, his friends would say, not very Georgian of him. Most Georgians were more relaxed, more easygoing, even about personal jokes. Now, Stalin's time at the seminary also may have encouraged a couple of other additional features in his personal political personality, his personal political culture. For one thing, while in the seminary he seems to have imbibed a real taste for dogma, for the sacredness of principles, and also for their easy definability, to make them easier to teach, to persuade people. And he would bring this spirit to Marxism, as we'll see in more detail. His insistence on faith in the future, in the possibilities of building socialism, seemed to reflect what he had learned at the seminary. He constantly, in later years, condemned all deviationists from the party line as if they were heretics. And he treated Lenin in particular, especially after his death, as a sacred figure. Secondly, the seminary may have encouraged in young Djugashvili, in the future Stalin, a Manichaean vision of the world, a view of the world as divided between right and wrong, good and evil, enemies and friends, with no gray areas in between. And in fact, this also was a heritage of the tradition of the Russian intelligentsia, but it's generally believed Stalin got this first at the seminary. Another noticeable trait in the young Stalin was an obsession with heroes and heroism. And this deserves particular attention. Throughout his life, young Stalin, the future Stalin, had special heroes, and he did everything he could to be like them. For example, when he was in elementary school, he took the nickname Koba, a rather telling choice of a young nickname. Koba was in no way his own name, but the hero of his favorite book, a novel by a Georgian writer, Alexander Kazbegi, the novel called, rather tellingly, given what we know about Stalin's relations with his own father, called The Patricide. And the hero of this book, Koba, was a 19th century fictional outlaw, sort of in the mold of Robin Hood, a sort of Georgian Robin Hood. He was strong and silent and chivalrous, courageous in battle, a perfect marksman, and always extremely cunning in defeating his enemies. Above all, he was an avenger of the oppressed. In this case, mostly Georgians against Russians, but also the poor against the rich. Djugashvili was very attached to this nickname and to the identity that went with it. It was his first underground party name after he joined the Social Democratic Party. He simply became known as Koba. And later, around 1910, when he took a new party name, a Stalin, also a heroic party name that means nothing less than Man of Steel, he still wanted his friends to call him not Yosef, not Stalin, but Koba. In fact, his first articles were signed K. Stalin, for Koba Stalin. Now, Stalin's political biography, his personal political history, reflected many of these traits and self-ideals. For example, it was characteristic that at a time when in Georgia, his native Georgia, most socialists were Mensheviks, preferring the more moderate, more democratic approach to creating a revolution and building socialism, Stalin immediately differed from the majority of Georgian socialists and became a Bolshevik. And there were a lot of things he really liked about Bolshevism. First of all, he was immediately impressed by Lenin's fundamental idea of the vanguard party of professional revolutionaries. This was, of course, a heroic ideal. It was an ideal that appealed to Stalin, for it focused on the best individuals heroically leading the way. It, of course, exalted the role of dedicated, committed rebels. In particular, this meant people like himself, and this appealed to him. He was also attracted by the Bolshevik reputation for toughness, for greater militance. Frankly, the Bolsheviks simply seemed, in this way too, more heroic. As an activist in the party, he was known for regularly criticizing leaflets, Bolshevik leaflets, which he argued were insufficiently radical, were insufficiently militant. And he developed a reputation among Bolsheviks as among the fiercest debaters, not necessarily the most sophisticated, but he made up for his often weaknesses in knowledge and in logic with great intensity, with great ferocity. Now, for Stalin, all of these ideal traits of Bolshevism that so attracted him to this movement were embodied in Lenin personally. Tellingly, though, Stalin was attracted not just by Lenin's ideas, which I've been describing, but also by Lenin's personal style, his own personal political culture. He liked the way Lenin talked. He liked his bold and aggressive style of speech, phrases that would come out of Lenin's mouth that, as Stalin later described them, that do not simply speak, but shoot. And in fact, in general, he was attracted to what had become the tradition of Bolshevik language, being so full of military imagery. Bolshevik leaflets were filled with images like the proletarian army, led by its advanced detachment, storming the fortresses of Tsarism. Stalin liked this style, and in fact, in his own writings, this became even more pervasive than it was among many other Bolsheviks. The military radicalism of Bolshevik language appealed to him and became his own. Equally important, of course, Stalin was attracted to Bolshevism by the person of Lenin himself, by Lenin's particular heroic persona, by his powerful will, by Lenin's self-confidence, by his charismatic power as a leader of the party. In fact, Stalin quite often liked to call Lenin the mountain eagle of the party, a heroic, romantic image. And during the great debates over policy in the 1920s that I've described last time, debates which were, of course, about policy, about the direction in building socialism, but also debates about power, about who would inherit the mantle of the ailing and then dead Lenin. Stalin generally, during these debates, expressed the conventional majority view within the party, the pro-NEP orthodoxy. He backed Bukharin, he backed the moderate majority in favor of an evolutionary course. However, a number of his major speeches and writings of this period suggest that this, in fact, was not his basic philosophical approach. In particular, it was already clear that he liked to place great emphasis in his writings in the 1920s on human will, on the importance and power of will from the human being. For example, in an essay in 1923, he argued that what was really characteristic about Lenin, about Leninism, was that it understood the subjective in history. And this made it superior to other forms of Marxism. He went even further in this sort of argument in a famous book and a very popular book he wrote in 1924 called Foundations of Leninism. And here he argued that Leninism was a special style, a special type of leadership. Again, elaborating on this notion of the subjective as key to Leninism. And he said in particular that in Leninism, there were two distinctive qualities. The first one he called Russian revolutionary sweep, Русский революционный размах. And the other he called American practicality, Американская деловитость. And the definitions of this Russian revolutionary sweep and American practicality are very revealing about how Stalin was already thinking differently about a policy in the 1920s, which would become very important in later years. As he put it, to have Russian revolutionary sweep meant to be innovative, to be visionary, to be daring. Russian revolutionary sweep was, in Stalin's words, I quote, an antidote to inertia, routine, mental stagnation, and slavish submission to ancient traditions. The other idea that was central to Leninism, American practicality, meant combining this Russian revolutionary sweep with practical activity, with actually getting things done. And this, he said, was a break on excessive subjectivism, on excessive willfulness. This was, he wrote in his own words, an antidote to the concoction of fantastic schemes, which he found to be quite characteristic of many Russian revolutionaries. But there was more in the way he talked about American practicality, more that was not necessarily so strong in its philosophical logic, but is very telling about Stalin's basic orientation to the world. In Stalin's hand, American practicality was not just practical, not just a restraint on excessive idealism, but it was also heroic. American practicality was, in a way, revolutionary in Stalin's view, in particular in relationship to reality. I quote, Stalin puts it well, American practicality is that indomitable force that neither knows nor recognizes obstacles, which with its getting things done perseverance brushes aside all obstacles. In other words, it too is about power and will and going beyond what seem to be the limits in the world. Reflecting all of this spirit, when Stalin criticized Trotsky in the 1920s, he accused Trotsky of lacking sufficient heroism, lacking sufficient optimism, sufficient faith. In particular, he claimed that one of Trotsky's leading theories, the idea of permanent revolution, which assumed that success, final success of socialism in Russia depended on worldwide socialist revolution, a conviction we know Lenin also held, Stalin complained that this theory of permanent revolution was in fact nothing but a theory of permanent hopelessness and showed a lack of faith in what the Russian people could achieve. Similarly, in 1928-29, when Stalin and his supporters turned against the pro-NEP arguments of Bukharin and others who were then called the right deviation, he criticized Bukharin and the right for their pessimism. They too didn't believe in what could be accomplished. As you might see, there's something of a religious spirit to Stalin's thought. Not, of course, belief in God, which Stalin rejected, but a faith, and he often used this term, in the party, in the proletariat, in Russia, in what people could accomplish. We could also see a sort of religious spirit in Stalin's tendency to simplify and sacralize all ideas, especially Lenin's. One sees it in his famous book of 1924, The Foundations of Leninism, in which he tried to make Lenin's ideas very simple, almost like a type of catechism of beliefs. It also is visible in his efforts, also in 1924, to get Lenin's body after his death embalmed and even put on display in Red Square, in which what some critics were already beginning to call a communist temple in the middle of the Soviet Union. One can also see this religious spirit in Stalin's constant references to Lenin's work as a testament to be followed. In fact, the word he uses to speak of Lenin's work as a testament was the same word used in Russian to speak of the New Testament, a Zavet, and one must be true to Lenin's testament. We'll return to Stalin's personality and his ideas, but first it's worth pausing to understand how he could have acquired so much power and influence in the 1920s, in which these ideas became very critical. Perhaps the most important factor in giving Stalin the power to act on these ideas, on these instincts even, was the changing structure of the party itself and Stalin's individual place in this new structure. During the Civil War, the whole structure of the apparatus of the party was reorganized. Until then, the party, the whole Communist Party, was governed by a rather small central committee led by Lenin. Other members included Trotsky, Bukharin, Stalin also, and 11 others. In 1919, realizing they needed to have a greater apparatus to advance the revolution, to run the civil war, to rule the country, this whole structure was changed. And instead of one central committee, which was relatively small, three bureaus of the central committee were formed, plus there still existed a larger central committee. The three bureaus were the Political Bureau, known as the Politburo, which made policy. This included Lenin, who was chair, Trotsky, Stalin, and a few Bukharin, and a few others, including Kamenev and Zinoviev, who we recall earlier had opposed one-party rule, but now were welcomed back into the leadership. It included an organizational bureau, or an org bureau, which recruited members and made appointments and handled assignments of party members around the country and took care of purges when party members were seen as not doing their job properly. Stalin chaired the organizational bureau, the org bureau. He also was a member of the government as the Commissar of Nationalities. And finally, a very powerful secretariat was created, which handled all the paperwork for both the Politburo and the org bureau. Very quickly, the secretariat grew in power, became increasingly important. In fact, by 1921 already, the secretariat essentially had gained responsibility, indeed usurped most of the everyday work of the organizational bureau, of the org bureau. It handled membership, who could become a member of the party. It handled appointments to various positions, reassignments, purges. And Stalin, who was seen as a good organizational man, loyal to Lenin, not necessarily a great intellectual, so not to be put in major policy-making positions, Stalin was made general secretary, the head of the secretariat, in 1922, though he also remained on the Politburo and the Org Bureau. In the hands of Stalin, these powers proved to be very impressive tools for strengthening his own influence within the party. It proved to be a way that he could fill various positions in the Communist Party with his own supporters, with loyalists. And in turn, of course, this meant filling government posts since the party controlled who was placed in important governmental positions. His most powerful level of control in this new apparatus were local party secretaries who he appointed. Technically, they had to be recommended and then approved, but in fact, they were simply appointed. All the recommendation from below and approved from the center was ignored, and he simply appointed them. And through the secretaries, he could control a very important party body, the Party Congress, which was declared to be the supreme power to make all fundamental decisions in the party. In fact, the Congress was also supposedly elected by local workers and communists, but in fact, the local secretaries usually decided who would go to the Party Congress, and of course, Stalin appointed the party secretaries. Sometimes this has been described as a sort of circular flow of power. The secretariat appointed secretaries. The secretaries chose the delegates to the party Congress. The party Congress chose who would be in the Central Committee. The Central Committee chose the party leadership, and it went around and around. And Stalin, as general secretary, held the key levers. That's worth saying, though, that the structure of the apparatus wasn't entirely to blame for this really dangerous centralization of bureaucratic power in the party and by extension in the state. The rank and file of the party could have been more assertive. It had rights to elect its officials, to elect its representatives that most members of the Communist Party didn't use. They simply chose not to exercise their rights. And there's a number of reasons why, and these are an important and really the second major condition, besides these changes in the structure, that gave Stalin exceptional influence. And this is changing composition in the members of the party itself during the Civil War and in the early years of NEP. There was an enormous increase in the membership of the Communist Party, particularly during the Civil War. As communist victory seemed likely, large numbers decided to be on the winning side. By the end of 1919, in fact, more than 80% of party members had only joined the party since it came to power. They were people who entered a party in power, not a revolutionary party seeking power. And this had a major impact, it's believed by most scholars, on political attitudes and behavior. A typical party member in the early 1920s was really quite different than a typical party member of the pre-revolutionary days. They tended to be less independent in their ideas. They tended to be more obedient to the party organization. Remember, in the Civil War, obedience and discipline was central to how the party was run. And we've already heard Trotsky's complaints about this submissiveness in the party. And historians agree. To quote one recent specialist on the Communist Party in these years, he writes, "The ordinary Bolshevik of the pre-revolutionary epoch, with his custom of saying exactly what he thought and acting accordingly, found himself now swimming against a tide of mass submissiveness at the party's grassroots. This was made worse in 1924, when Lenin died, by what was called the Lenin enrollment, which Stalin in particular promoted. 500,000 workers were brought into the party, virtually doubling membership. This was described as the worker democracy many people were asking for. In fact, most of these new members joined the party as a means of upward mobility. Party membership gave you influence and opportunity for better jobs in the society. And the result was to create a vast reservoir of essentially grateful and submissive members. In other words, the Lenin enrollment paradoxically undermined democracy in the party, for it weakened the spirit of criticism and debate that had been part of the party's tradition. Stalin, of course, could make good use of this obedience, for he controlled the party apparatus. As a result, he built networks of loyal supporters. He could keep track of critics, people who stood up and criticized him or whatever policy line he was interested in. At a meeting, he could easily have them reassigned because that was his job. And this administrative power played a critical role in Stalin's ability to defeat various party oppositions in the 1920s. First, he used his control to get rid of Trotsky and his allies in 1923 to 24. Then he used it to get rid of Zinoviev and Kamenev, who took Trotsky's position in 1925. Then, when Trotsky and Zinoviev and Kamenev and their followers united into what was called the left opposition, all still arguing about these issues of industrialization and democracy within the party, Stalin could also throw their members out of the party and defeat them. And finally, when in 1928 Stalin turns against Bukharin and the so-called right opposition, he could also use his power within the party to remove their members, to defeat them in debates, to have them voted out of the leadership. Now, once Stalin succeeded in becoming the dominant leader in the party, largely engineered through his technical power within the party, he made his heroic and willful political cultural style the hallmark of the times themselves. Given his personality, as we've already seen, given his style, it's not surprising, and we've seen indications of this, that he felt, in fact, quite uncomfortable with Bukharin's ideas about NEP is so gradual. In particular, Bukharin once said NEP was a process of riding to socialism on the back of a peasant nag. For Stalin, he imagined himself in a more on a more gallant steed, on a more heroic and willful course than this. Of course, Stalin could have done little to change policy had this all been only about him and his instincts and his personality. One has to admit, he touched a nerve, certainly among communists, but also among many workers and others in society. He spoke to the dissatisfactions of many in Soviet Russia in the 1920s. First, of course, one has to remember the economic problems that I've described before, slowing economic growth in the late 1920s, the inability to overcome, to go beyond the pre-war levels due to lack of new investment capital. Problems also began to emerge with grain production and sales. Peasants saw little to buy and therefore began to grow less grain again. An economic crisis began to brew. But there were also political problems with NEP. Part of it was international. There was growing talk in the Soviet Union in the mid-1920s that a war of the capitalist countries against the USSR was likely, indeed even certain. And the country was clearly unprepared for this, in the sense that one needed to push industrial preparedness forward began to be an important political debate. But most important, and I've already indicated this a little before, there was extensive domestic discontent with the policies of the new economic policy period among rank-and-file communists, among workers, and especially among young people. There was growing dissatisfaction, a growing desire, in fact, for a more, like Stalin wanted, a more heroic and aggressive approach to building communism, something more like during the fighting years of the Civil War. Many things about NEP bothered many, many Russians, young, worker, communists in particular. The inequalities, the rise of the new rich in the city, people called NEP men, wealthy traders, or in the countryside, richer peasants called kulaks. They didn't like this. They didn't like the gradualism. They didn't even like the cultural and intellectual pluralism. Why should so many old ideas still be around? Better to create a society that was thoroughly heroic and revolutionary. And a rather good expression of this discontent comes from a novel written in 1925 by Fyodor Gladkov called Cement. And in one scene, a woman declares her feelings about NEP. She was a former Red Army soldier and now a member of the Communist Party. "We've destroyed and we've suffered, but suddenly the past rises again with a joyful sound. I don't know where the nightmare is, in those years of blood, misery, and sacrifice, or in now, in this current bacchanalia of rich shop windows and drunken cafes. What was the good of the mountains of corpses? So that scoundrels and vampires would again enjoy all the good things in life and get fat by robbery?" And as this suggests, there was something even more about people's distaste with Knapp, what might be described as a sort of aesthetic, a moral revulsion at all the compromises, at all the inequalities of Knapp. One sign of this moral revulsion was a heightened number of suicides during the late 1920s, including quite famous ones such as that of Vladimir Mayakovsky, once a great idealist of the revolutions. But others talked about a new heroic revolutionary advance, the sort that Stalin was ready to provide. And the main policy expression of this was a massive program launched around 1928 of industrial and social and indeed cultural transformation of the country. A rather good expression of the spirit that was going to motivate this sort of drive was expressed by a chief economist working for Stalin in 1927, in which he said, "Our task is not to study economics, but to change it. We are bound by no laws. There are no fortresses that a Bolshevik can't storm." And this slogan, "there are no fortresses that Bolsheviks cannot storm," would in fact become one of Stalin's favorite expressions and would be heard everywhere during these years after 1928. In fact, these words in many ways captured the essence of Stalin's political personality, as we've seen, and the essence of the emerging Stalinist political culture. And this is the story to which we'll turn next.
Lecture 31, Stalin's Revolution.
In 1928, as I've already indicated, Stalin began to distance himself from Bukharin and the gradualist, market-based ideas of the new economic policy period of Knapp. Instead, he began to lead the party and the state, and indeed the whole of the Soviet Union, toward a radical policy of state-directed industrialization, a policy that was, in fact, even more extreme than anything Trotsky had proposed and certainly lacked the democratization within the party that Trotsky had said had to be part of this new revolution. This so-called revolution from above of Stalin, which had enormous consequences for millions of Russian and Soviet people, both positive and devastating consequences, is the subject of this lecture. Now, Stalin's change of course requires some explaining. The most cynical interpretation was offered by Bukharin, as he told Lev Kamenev, who had been allied with Trotsky before, and this is a point at which Bukharin is now the enemy of Stalin. In 1928, Bukharin told Kamenev the following. He explained it as rather simple, what Stalin was up to. "Stalin," he said, "is an unprincipled intriguer who subordinates everything to the preservation of his own power. He changes his theories according to whom he needs to get rid of at any given moment." It was now, of course, Bukharin's turn to be gotten rid of, and hence he changed all of his policies. And, of course, Stalin had the administrative capacity to get rid of who he needed to at any given moment. A slight variation of this cynical interpretation, though also in many ways Machiavellian, is that Stalin was always committed to a more aggressive industrialization strategy than Bukharin was, than the right was, but he kept his views in the background for the purpose of defeating the political and economic program of Trotsky and the left, partly because he personally hated Trotsky and needed to get rid of him, but also in order to ensure his own ability to push the correct policy without competition. And in fact, we saw some evidence of this notion that Stalin secretly favored a more radical policy and kept it hidden when we talked about Stalin's own political orientation. However, it's also possible that there was a gradual evolution in Stalin's thinking, as in that of many others within the party leadership, an evolution toward a more radical course that was prompted by this complex combination of economic and social and political pressures of the 1920s that we've partly already looked at. Economic problems, especially severe by 1927, when it was clear that growth was really slowing rapidly, and food supplies were being delivered to the city in smaller and smaller quantities, and of course also by the growing discontent with NEP, which we've already seen. Whatever the causes of Stalin's turn against the policies of NEP, his turn for a more radical course of transforming society and building socialism, it's clear that once this turn took place, which became known as the Great Turn, it looked very much like a new revolution, or a new civil war, even. Militant class struggle, idealistic faith in the cause, collective and individual heroism, and a good deal of brutality and suffering. One sees this new militancy, for example, even in the economic plans on paper that were being announced at the end of the 1920s, especially in 1928 and after. The drafts of the first five-year plan in particular, which was to cover the years from 1928 to 1932. As these plans began to appear in 1928, early 1928, Bukharin's comments about them were absolutely scathing. He argued there really ought to be a difference between optimism and stupidity. Indeed, these plans for economic growth were optimistic to an extreme. During the drafting of the first five-year plan, there were strong political pressures coming from Stalin, in particular, to be more ambitious. In fact, when the plan showed up, it was sometimes sent back and said, it's too weak. Be more daring. Be more bold. The result was that when the final draft, which was unveiled only in 1929, though to start a policy that was already beginning to be underway, the targets for what had to be achieved in this first five-year plan period were almost mythical ideals. They proposed in this period of 5 years to quadruple the amount of electricity produced in the Soviet Union, to triple the amount of iron and steel manufactured, and also on top of all that, to increase the production of consumer goods, even while expanding in all areas of heavy industry. In fact, most economic historians looking at these written plans agree that the targets of the first five-year plan were completely impractical. There was simply no human way one could achieve such goals. In fact, to quote one well-known economic historian, he writes, in the absence of divine intervention, it's hard to imagine how these goals could have been achieved. However, from the point of view of the enthusiasts of this industrial revolution from above, and especially from the point of view of Stalin himself, the plan wasn't impossible enough. Very soon after this plan was unveiled, its target figures were raised even further. Then, for good measure, at the end of 1929, it was decided to fulfill the five-year plan and all of its targets, not in 5 years, but in 4 years. And on top of this, further amendments kept coming, raising the targets. And on top of this still, the goal was not just to achieve these absolutely impossible goals, but everybody should try to over-fulfill the already impossible plan. One could hardly underestimate the hubris in all this, the sort of utopian, mythic thinking. Everything was possible. For example, geography itself, nature itself, was to be remade with huge industrial sites and massive dams and huge canals. Rivers were to be rerouted. People, too, it was said, should be remade in the midst of this industrial revolution, or in the vocabulary of the time, people should be reforged or rebuilt. To quote, for example, from a 1931 pamphlet on the building of a massive steel factory in the Ural Mountains, it said, it's not only the mountain and the steppe that are being rebuilt. Man himself is being rebuilt. In fact, when looking at all this, one could fairly argue that the first five-year plan was not, in fact, in any way a real economic plan, not a guide to actual investment and desired outputs. The first five-year plan really, in many ways, was a political manifesto. It was a call to heroic struggle. It was designed to inspire people to greater and greater accomplishments. In fact, the whole atmosphere of this first five-year plan reflected this, one might describe as the politicization of economics. And typical of Bolshevism, especially of Stalin's variety of Bolshevism, this meant the militarization of economics, evoking a revolutionary war. Thus, the press typically talked about industry as a sort of battlefield. Talked about fronts, the steel front, the electricity front. It talked about campaigns. And when things were achieved, it talked about a breakthrough, as if this was a war. Shock troops, as they were called, shock troops of workers, were put together and rushed to a particular factory or a construction site in order to fulfill or even overfulfill goals. Many young people, again, as during the Civil War, young communists volunteered, or in many cases were encouraged to volunteer, to work on these huge projects, such as the Magnitogorsk metallurgical factory in the Urals, or huge dams that were being built to generate electricity. And these volunteers considered themselves, or at least were treated officially, as heroic fighters on the industrialization front. Finally, completing the picture of this militarization of economics, turning it into a revolutionary war, those who urged more rational policies be adopted, things that made more sense economically, or people who failed in their tasks, and many people did, needless to say, were treated as if they were traitors in wartime. They were fired, they were often arrested, they were condemned as what was called bourgeois wreckers, even if they were workers by definition. They were bourgeois if they opposed this industrialization effort, and many were sent to prison camps in these years. Now, the economic results of this revolution in economics from above were mixed. On the one hand, growth, as you might imagine, was extremely unbalanced. Heavy industry tended to develop at the expense of consumer goods. Partly this is because this is where investment really ultimately was given priority. In building up heavy industry, machine tool plants, and the like, but also because in 1930, all private manufacturing and all private trade were abandoned, were made illegal. And this, of course, was an area in small trade and small manufacturing that the state had no interest in filling. So large numbers of consumer products ceased to exist, a very unbalanced economic process. In fact, even heavy industry, which was the center of attention, suffered from imbalanced growth. Among major problems that one sees are shortages of raw materials, including fuel and supplies. A desire to produce a certain number of machines was decided, but they never were sure where to find the raw materials for it. There was also the problem of overproduction. Many factories would produce things, pieces of machinery, for example, that no other factory was prepared to make use of. So large amounts of manufactured goods, parts meant to go into other manufactured goods, mainly machinery, tended to be left outside of factories simply to rust. Quality also suffered in this sort of industrialization development movement, since the emphasis was always on quantity much more than on quality. There also, one should add, in terms of a type of imbalance in this process, given that this is a socialist movement, were very, very bad working and living conditions for workers in these big new factories, and indeed even in the old industry. At the same time, it's fair to say that the achievements of the first five-year plan were quite considerable. Production did increase considerably, though obviously nowhere near the impossible targets that had been set, though we don't actually know how much production increased since all official statistics were so unreliable, the facts are hard to see. But it's clear that production increased at a much more rapid rate, and certainly overcoming the slow rates of the 1920s. Whole new industrial areas were in fact constructed as a result of these big industrial construction projects. In the Urals, for example, Magnitogorsk, which I mentioned, a big hydroelectric plant in the Ukraine. Siberia was developed, all of which played an important part in future economic development. And most important, it's argued by economic historians, a foundation was laid by this rapid push, a foundation for future sustained growth that would take place during the following five-year plans, none of which had this sort of extremism